This is the first taped interview with Ivan Walter in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 15th of the 9th, 2000, for the RSL and Veterans Affairs Oral History Project, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Ivan, I thought we should start the interview by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please.
Well, my full name is Ivan Malcolm Walter. And I was born in Albany, Western Australia, on the 14th of May, 1924.
Could you tell us a little bit about your family background and that sort of thing?
Yes, my family lived in Cranbrook, which was 56 miles from Albany. And my grandmother brought me up because my mother died 3 weeks after I was born. So my grandmother, already having 13 children of her own, well, I was number 14 and became one of the family. You want me to go?
So you were living in a country town in the southwest of Western Australia.
Actually, it was called the Great Southern. Yeah.
What about your father?
My father, he was a First World War infantryman, and he was the local builder. But, of course, he... when my mother died, he broke up quite a bit, and although he did remarry about 8 years later, I stayed with my grandmother's family until she passed away when I was 7 or 8.
What about your father's service in the First World War? What stories and things like that did he tell you?
Dad used to tell me quite a few things. He was in the 51st Battalion, and he was wounded in France in 1917, and after several months in hospitals in England and back in Australia, he was discharged late in 1917. But on my mother's side, two of her brothers were killed on Gallipoli on the same day, on the attack at Hill 60, where Hugo Throssell, in the VC, he was their commanding officer. And a younger brother of hers won a military medal with the 44th Battalion in France.
Mm-hmm. What was the general feeling as a boy about the First World War?
Well, they were all heroes to us young chaps. We used to go to the Anzac Day service and listen to the old diggers telling their stories. We could see the mateship between them, and I guess we grew up just wanting to be a digger's too.
Mm. What was the feeling of Gallipoli? Because obviously that's quite an important...
Oh, Gallipoli to us kids, well, it was a, you know, we were told the story at school and coming up to Anzac Day, and of course having the two uncles killed there, well, Gallipoli meant such a lot to our family. Mm. As a matter of fact, I now have with me a copy of the diary written by one of my uncles from the time he joined the 10th Light Horse until the day he was killed on Gallipoli.
Is it possible for you to share with us some of his remembrances or thoughts of the time when he was writing the diary?
Yes.
What sort of things stick out in your mind as some of the things he would write down?
Well, he mainly covered what his section and squadron were doing, and also it was quite interesting the time on the ship on the way to Gallipoli, and once they were on the island, on Gallipoli, very interesting to see how they had to go on water parties, and the time when they were off duty, they'd go down to the open beach and swim with shrapnel, you know, around, and they were also put into tunnelling parties and had to tunnel. It was just, it's really unreal, but...
What's the atmosphere that you get from of Gallipoli, from those diaries, do you think?
Well, I just think that... Well, it was very unfortunate that our troops had to go in where they did. It was supposedly at the wrong place where they landed, but to think that they were mown down and killed like they were, it was very sad.
So, as a boy, what do you think your aspirations were for your future? What did you want to be when you grew up, do you think?
Well, I could answer that very quickly. I wanted to be a good footballer and a good cricketer. In those days, living in a small country town, well, you didn't think you'd ever leave there. But, of course, having so many relatives, because my family could put a cricket team in, they used to have a game versus the world and put in 11 from our family. Of course, when the war started, and as I mentioned to you before, my grandfather had 14 grandsons from that area go to the war, mostly in the army. But we did have one of the boys went down on the Perth in the Sunda Straits, and another died on the Burma railway line, and two were killed in action in the army. But I've lost track of what.
You were talking about what you thought your future might be. Right?
Yes. I just thought I'd be working with my dad as a carpenter, and but of course, when the war finished, we'd seen so much of other parts that the family seemed to just go all over Western Australia to different places, some in the railways, some, you know, to other towns, and
so the small home country town wasn't big enough anymore.
Not really. There wasn't the work there for one thing. You couldn't hope to get more than labouring on farms or as I would have done. I did go back to building with my dad for a couple of years and then took a course in post-war rehabilitation in Albany and qualified as a carpenter and joiner.
Could you give us an impression of what it was like growing up during the Depression in a small country town?
Yes, during the Depression years, money wasn't an object because there wasn't any. We used to play sport as much as we could. The football would be fairly old and never a new cricket ball, but we still had our teams, and everyone seemed to take part in sport. Or once a month, perhaps, you'd get a dance in the local hall or one of the little halls in up to a radius of 20 miles from Cranbrook. But we used to enjoy our dancing. And
there was never a feel of doing without, necessarily.
Not at all, because you never had it, so you were quite happy with, you know, things as they were.
I'm interested to know what the general feeling was when the problems in Europe started to be talked about, and when Hitler was starting to be talked about, when the possibility of a Second World War might be on the horizon.
Yes, well, I'd say about 14 when the war started, possibly 15. Straight away, the young boys that were old enough in the country, they joined up the army or the navy, and away they went. And I know that the younger ones, like myself, we were just waiting for the day when we could do the same thing. As a matter of fact, when I was 16, I applied to join the navy, which at that time you had to sign up for 12 years. I signed up for 12 years and put in my application and got a letter back to say that applications had closed, but to reapply at a later date. About that time, the Sunday Times were running an advert, join air crew at 17. So I put in an application, got a ticket sent to me to go to Perth for an examination. I had a medical and an aptitude test in Perth and passed that. Now they said, here's 21 books. Go back, contact your local school teacher, and when you get to 18, you'll be called up. And I thought this was a bit of a letdown because they said join at 17. So I just put my age up and applied to be called up in the militia, because at that time you had to be 19 to join the IAF, and there's no way I look 19. And one of my uncles threatened to put me into the authorities if I put my age up and got in. So I put my age up and went into the militia, and eventually arrived at Northern Camp. After so much training there, a group of us were sent to the 28th Battalion, which was a militia battalion at that time, but later joined the AIF. And I was with the 28th Battalion for about 6 months, and they were to be sent to Darwin. So all of us young chaps under 19 were taken out of the battalion and sent to the 5th Victorian Battalion, because we were not old enough to go to a frontline area. I was in the 5th Battalion for a short time, and I was at Chidlow's Wells at the time in camp, and I got called up to the orderly room, and the officer there said, "Your brother in the 2nd 11th Battalion has claimed you, do you want to go?" And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Well, get your pack now," and he said, "We'll drive you straight over to the 2nd 11th, which he did. So that same day I arrived, and my cousin had, in the 8-man tent, there were 7 of them, and he had this spot kept for me in the tent, and from then on, until he was killed in New Guinea, we were together.
What was his name?
His name was Neil Cranston O'Neill, but he was always known as Pat as a boy, and in Cranbrook, they'd all know him as Pat, but in the army that was changed to Paddy. So he was Paddy from then on.
I get the impression that there was no hesitation to join the armed forces then.
Absolutely none. We couldn't get there quick enough.
Initially, when Hitler was starting to make himself known,
yes,
36 on,
yes,
as someone wanting room for Germany and things like that, what was the general feeling in Australia toward Germany and Hitler?
Well, truly, at the age of 14 or 15, we didn't consider it too much. We just knew there was a war on, and we thought it was similar to the 1914-18, when all our relatives and fathers and so forth went, that we just wanted to be there. So I don't know if we was fighting for the king and country or for ourselves, but we just wanted to be in.
There was no concern that it was going to be like the First World War, and the atrocities that had been known were going to be duplicated there.
Oh, no way, no. We didn't know actually what to expect, but whatever it was, we were ready to go. I mightn't be putting this very well, but...
So, you were in the 2nd 11th.
Yes.
Where were you then to be sent?
Well, after joining the 2nd 11th, we were moved down to Collie for a while, and we started a jungle training school in Collie, Wellington Dam.
There's not much jungle in Collie, is
there? No, but out around Wellington Dam there was a fair bit of growth there, so we did our best. And after that, we were sent to Wandekla in Queensland, North Queensland, on the Atherton Tablelands. And I think we were there 14 months training, and we were, you know, all terribly fit, and but getting very, very bored with being so long there and not getting away overseas. And on November the 5th, 1944, we sailed from Townsville on the Katoomba and landed at Idapi in New Guinea.
Tell us what the general, because a lot of people have said to me that they didn't really consider the war to be terribly much of a problem until the Japanese had come in. Could you give us a bit of an impression of what the stories were relating to the Japanese and the threat that they posed?
Well, my recollection at that time was the Japs were doing so well coming down, you know, the Malaysian coast and through Singapore, and I thought, gee, we're all going to be slaves before too long, and they'll be overrun the country, and I'm not going to wait here and wait till they come. I'm going to go up there and meet them. But you know, I just wanted to get in the army with the rest of my mates. And
what sort of propaganda were you faced with?
I can't recall any propaganda.
What were you told about the Japanese and the sort of...
Yes, well, we just thought they were animals, you know, brutal and oppressive, and we'd got word through that, you know, a cousin of mine was died on the Burma railway line, and, well, we knew that they weren't very nice people. Yeah.
At the time, when the Japanese had been bombing Darwin and Broome,
yeah,
and sort of making their presence felt in Australia,
yeah,
Curtin began to then look towards America. What was the general feeling about that?
Well, it's hard for me to say now. I guess we were terribly pleased the Yanks were coming in to help, but we didn't have a lot of love for the Japs, seeing how they carried on in the cities like Perth and Melbourne and Sydney, where we'd seen them. But still, they did a wonderful job, and I think we'd have been lost without them.
You mean the servicemen, the American servicemen?
Yeah.
What about MacArthur? What was the general feeling toward him?
Well, my first thoughts on MacArthur was early is that he was a great soldier and a great man, but reading so much after the war about him, where he used to set up landings, you know, and have these photographers there, and I, you know, didn't think the same about him. But at that time, early in the war, I thought he was a very good soldier and doing a good job.
At the time of the Japanese, the height of the Japanese invasion of Malaysia and coming down to the Malaysian Peninsula and then hitting Australia, what was the feeling in Australia towards the invasion, the likelihood of the invasion?
Yeah, well, there was a very great concern, because I remember even in that little town of Cranbrook, well off the coast, the cars had their headlights were covered over, and we had to have blinds on our windows, and we had a local VDC. Even I was in the VDC at about 14, and we used to get out there with the old soldiers and learn to slope arms and what have you. But and then there was talk of a German spy in the hills, and the Stirling Ranges, and he'd been captured. But, you know, there was quite a lot of worry.
Mm-hmm. There was talk of evacuating Australia from the Brisbane line.
Yes. That doesn't ring much of a bell with me, because, you know, we were probably well above the Brisbane line then.
The Australian government, with the risk of the Japanese invasion, had expanded the army. Yeah. Did you feel at the time that the Australian army was prepared, well enough equipped to face the onslaught of possible Japanese soldiers?
Yeah, well, you know, my thoughts were that although I had a lot of faith in the Australian soldier, I thought we were too thinly spread out, you know, to stop the Japs, because, you know, we couldn't cover all the big country that we've got.
What about your equipment? What were you given? What was your service issue?
Well, equipment. You mean what the section or platoon has?
No, your uniform and rifle that you were supplied with, that sort of thing.
Yes. Well, of course we had the normal army uniform and the slouch hat, and I don't think I got an issue of a rifle until I got to the infantry battalion. That was the 28th Battalion. And most of my service, I just had the 303, although for a short time I carried a 2-inch mortar and had a revolver on the hip, but I was never a Bren gunner or a Owen gunner.
I get the impression that people felt that the service issue was a bit out of date.
Well, at that time, I don't think our chaps considered it was out of date. It was the going thing at the time, and well, most of us were good rifle shots when we went in, because from the time I could handle a rifle, I used to go kangaroo shooting, and I'm sure most of the country boys who went in the army were quite used to handling weapons, and especially rifles, and it was a big advantage.
Was there a big difference, do you think, country boys going into the army than city slickers?
I really think so, because some of the country boys had a pretty tough life, you know, working on farms and that from daylight till dark, 7 days a week, and living in humpies. And but I know that most of our company were country boys, although we did have a large group from Kalgoorlie who were really used to tough conditions.
So you volunteered to join the army, obviously.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
You weren't a choco. What did it mean to be a choco?
Well, I had to go through the militia, or the chocos, because of my age. That's when I put my age up. But I couldn't get out of it quick enough because I wanted to be AIF.
What did it mean to be this choco, the chocolate soldier?
Oh, it hurt very much, because most of the, well, a big majority at that time were young chaps that couldn't get in the AIF or any of the other services, and it was really tough. It was, you know, something you didn't want to be in, and yet you had to be there.
So tell us about signing on. What did you have to agree to do?
Well, as far as I can remember, all I had to do was sign up to... well, I can't recall what I signed up to do, but I know I signed up probably to defend the country and the king. And
was there a sense of adventure that you were off to war? And...
Oh, definitely, yes, yeah. The mateship and that, because when I went first in the army, there was about 7 or 8 other chaps that I knew went in at the same time, and we were together for some time. But you didn't have to be there long till you made new friends, and it really didn't matter if you split up then.
You went to Queensland before you would head off to New Guinea.
Yes.
Could you describe the level of training that you received up there?
Well, when we got to Wandekla, the training was really, it was quite tough. We'd go out on 7-day manoeuvres, and there'd be long marches and carrying heavy packs, and the conditions weren't the best. It was very hilly country, and but it was all to our own benefit, because it made us super fit. And, well, us young chaps, we could go on and on. It didn't affect us. And, it, as I said before, it was all to our own benefit.
Things like rations and that sort of thing that are really...
Oh, well, in the army, there's always moans about food and not enough, or not well cooked. And the cooks were usually called greasies. And
so you knew that you were going to go to New Guinea?
Yes.
Yeah. What stories were you hearing from that part of the world about what was going on there?
Oh, well, from friends and others that had been up there, and that we knew we were in for a tough time, not only with the weather, but unfortunately New Guinea was a place where there was no safe positions, you know, from the time you landed there. Well, from Itaipu to Wewak, you didn't know where the Japs were, and... it was always in the back of your mind that you had to be super protective and keep an eye out, because just one sniper around the place could kill a couple of chaps.
What had you heard of things like the Kokoda Trail, that sort of thing?
Well, we'd learnt a lot about the Kokoda Track. And of course, having friends that were there, and we thought they'd done a wonderful job. And although I will admit that they had it much harder in that sector than we did in the Itapewiwa campaign.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you know of the Kokoda Track and the experiences that those soldiers had?
Well, anything I could read on the Kokoda Track, I've read, and I have most of it in my library here, but they definitely had a shocking time there initially till they turned back the Japs. That's where the 39th Militia Battalion got such a wonderful name. And together with the 2nd 16th and the 2nd 14th Battalion, we owe them a lot of thanks for what they did in turning back the advance of the Japanese. As a matter of fact, an original officer from our battalion, the 2nd 11th, he commanded the 39th Battalion, Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Honor, and he's just written a book which I've just finished reading now, and there's no doubt that it was a shocking campaign, and those chaps put up with more than they should have done, with lack of equipment, lack of food, and a very aggressive Japanese.
Do you think that there have been lessons learned at the Kokoda Track that were then being passed on to you through your officers and things like that?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. There was lessons learnt there. And, of course, chaps that were in units on the track, some units were broken up, and we got quite a few to our unit in Queensland before we went to New Guinea. And it was a great help to listen to these guys and to know what they went through. And I can only say that they did a mighty job.
What were some of the toughest things that they told you about that they'd experienced?
Well, it was just the lack of equipment. They had boots worn out. Their clothes were in rags. They had very little food. It was hard to maintain contact with the different groups, and they just had a shocking time, and I think that what they went through was actually the worst part of the Pacific War.
General MacArthur's idea was to get initially control of the Pacific region, but to get to the Philippines.
Yes.
He was working with people like Blamey. What was the general view of generals and officers like Blamey?
Well, I know Blamey made a lot of enemies through comments he made when he flew up to Moresby and said some things that were better left unsaid about the fighting soldier, that they were running like rabbits, and only the rabbits that ran got shot, and didn't have a lot of respect for Tom Blamey.
Was that a general?
That was general, yes. That was very general.
And what about the government at the time and how they were sort of controlling things? What was the general feeling?
Well, we really didn't think much about the government, because we hadn't been into politics being so young. A lot of us hadn't even voted by that time, or we did get a vote before I was discharged, but no, we didn't worry much about the government. We guessed they were doing the right thing, but we had a bit of criticism for chaps like Blamey, and mainly Blamey.
What about your other immediate officers that were in?
Well, I'd say 99% of our officers were very good men and did a good job. It wasn't an easy job, and there's one or two that failed a bit. But apart from that, the majority did a very good job.
Mm. What made a good officer, a good person to be in control of troops?
Well, one that maintained discipline, and one that was really one of the boys. He could, you know, up there we were all on first names. There was no sir this or sir that. And well, some of them just had the natural ability to do the right thing when you were fired on, and some were a little bit lacking.
Tell us about going to ITP. What was the trip like?
Well, the ship, the voyage on the Katoomba wasn't the best as far as I was concerned. I was seasick most of the way, but the trouble is we were bedded down in the hold, and all you could smell down there was diesel oil and food being cooked.